the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Great, let's read then, shall we, from the Book of Lamentations. We're going to read Lamentations chapter 4 tonight, and we're starting at verse 1, which is on page 783 of the Green Bible, if you've got that in front of you. How the gold has lost its luster, the fine gold become dull. The sacred gems are scattered at every street corner. How the precious children of Zion, once worth their weight in gold, are now considered as pots of clay, the work of a potter's hands. Even jackals offer their breasts to nurse their young. But my people have become heartless like ostriches in the desert. Because of thirst, the infant's tongue sticks to the roof of its mouth. The children beg for bread, but no one gives it to them. Those who once ate delicacies are destitute in the streets. Those nurtured in purple now lie on ash heaps. The punishment of my people is greater than that of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment without a hand turned to help her. Their princes were brighter than snow and whiter than milk, their bodies more ruddy than rubies, their appearance like lapis lazuli. But now they are blacker than soot. They're not recognized in the streets. Their skin has shriveled on their bones. It's become as dry as a stick. Those killed by the sword are better off than those who die of famine. Racked with hunger, they waste away for lack of food from the field. With their own hands, compassionate women have cooked their own children, who became their food when my people were destroyed. The Lord has given full vent to his wrath. He has poured out his fierce anger. He kindled a fire in Zion that consumed her foundations. The kings of the earth did not believe, nor did any of the peoples of the world, that enemies and foes could enter the gates of Jerusalem. But it happened because of the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests who shed within her the blood of the righteous. Now they grope through the streets as if they were blind. They are so defiled with blood that no one dares to touch their garments. Go away, you are unclean, people cry to them. Away, away, don't touch us. When they flee and wander about, people among the nations say they can stay here no longer. The Lord himself has scattered them. He no longer watches over them. The priests are shown no honor, the elders no favor. Moreover, our eyes failed, looking in vain for help. From our towers, we watched for a nation that could not save us. People stalked us at every step, so we could not walk in our streets. Our end was near. Our days were numbered, for our end had come. Our pursuers were swifter than eagles in the sky. They chased us over the mountains and lay in wait for us in the desert. The Lord's anointed, our very life breath, was caught in their traps. We thought that under his shadow we would live among the nations. Rejoice and be glad, daughter Edom, you who live in the land of Uz, but to you also the cup will be passed. You will be drunk and stripped naked. Your punishment will end, daughter Zion. He will not prolong your exile. But he will punish your sin, daughter Edom, and expose your wickedness. Well, in the comments made about Lamentations so far tonight, and I guess every week of this series, although I wasn't here last week, so I'm not very sure, there's a kind of, we've got to do a Lamentations sometime note, so let's get on with it, even if it's not great for a summer evening. And that's understandable, isn't it? Because Lamentations is an unfamiliar and unlikely book in lots and lots of ways. I think many of us who are evangelical Christians prefer those bits of the Bible that have a kind of straightforward logical argument going through them. The letters of Paul are great. The stories of Jesus are great because they mean all kinds of different things, and you can think about the internal structure and the meaning and so on and so forth. But Lamentations is a difficult book to deal with. It seems to dodge about all over the place. It seems to repeat itself so often. What you've got here are five chapters, five poems, and they all seem very similar to one another. And it's difficult, isn't it, to keep your interest going. Oh dear, he said that already, hasn't he? He said that back in chapter 2. And it can be difficult, I think, just working out exactly what's going on then, there. And yet, you know, down through the years, people who have suffered, people who've been through grief, people who've been through nightmare scenarios and heartbreak, have found Lamentations an incredibly comforting book. Doesn't sound as if it ought to be comforting, does it? Because it's a catalogue of disasters from one end to the other, and in fact we've called this night's instalment horror. And yet there's something in Lamentations which I think speaks to a deeper level than the logical in us. And it says God knows what it's like to go through terrible, terrible trouble. This is the book in the Bible, I think, that best understands the alchemy of grief, what it feels like to be grieving. And especially what it feels like to be grieving when it's your fault. Has God abandoned you? Has God cut you off? Have you gone too far? Have you drifted over the line? Is there no mercy? Is there no forgiveness left? To people who battle with feelings like that, Lamentations is a tremendous book. Because it's there in the Bible to show us that God understands that kind of feeling. And so, the five parts of it do have a kind of a structure, and there are various ways in which you can structure it. I suppose you could say, one way of looking at it is like this, to say, chapter one is about what happened, the story of the downfall of Jerusalem, a depiction of the different things that went on, and chapter five is more about how we respond to the whole thing. Because in chapter five it starts out, remember, Lord, what has happened to us, look and see our disgrace. And chapter five is more of a direct appeal to God than any other chapter. Chapter one is more of an initial description, and so those two balance one another. Moving a bit further in, you've got another balancing pair. You've got chapter two and chapter four. If chapter two is talking about why it happened, because of sin, because of guilt, because the people of Israel wouldn't listen to a warning from God and therefore just reached the point where they'd gone way, way beyond his mercy and God had to act in judgment. Then chapter 4 again balances it because it talks about what judgment looks like. What is judgment when you get down to it? What kinds of things will God do to his people? And we're going to look at that kind of thing a bit more tonight. And in the middle of it is chapter 3. Now, I've deliberately put it down that way because I think chapter 3, in some ways, is the whole point of the book. It's a book that's arranged circularly, if you like, or it's arranged like a mirror image of itself. And the middle of it, in chapter 3, is the real point of it. Now, we're used to reading books in which chapter 1 introduces the argument, chapter 2 takes it forward, chapter 3 introduces a counter-argument, chapter 4 answers a counter-argument, chapter 5 propounds a thesis a bit longer, chapter 6 gives some examples, and chapter 7 is, therefore, and you get the whole point of the book, right at the end. Lamentations is not a book like that. It's a book where I think you find the meaning in the middle. And the meaning is in chapter 3, in those tremendous verses that talk about God's mercies being new every morning. The verses that talk about, let us examine our ways and test them and let us return to the Lord. And when that happens, when you go back to the Lord, you can expect forgiveness. Because the God of wrath is also the God of mercy. That, I think, is where the whole book is tending. And you don't understand chapter 4 if you think, well, we've had a moment of brightness in chapter 3 and now it's all back to the doom and gloom again. It's not that way. It's all heading towards chapter 3. Or another way of looking at it is to say, well, who's speaking in each chapter? Because in chapters 1 and 2, the speaker is female. We know that from the structure of the language. And so it seems to be Jerusalem herself who's talking most of the time. The widow, the city, bereft, on her own. And chapters 4 and 5 are the us laments, because they're the corporate bit. They're talking about what we have to do together as we face this situation. So in 1 and 2, you're talking about the whole city of Jerusalem. In chapter 4 and 5, you're zoning on the people who live there and the nation of Israel and saying, what can we do as a people bearing this corporate guilt? All of us guilty, all of us standing before God, having done things together which are awful. It's not just my sins and your sins, it's our sins, the things we've done corporately, the things our society has stood for. That's got to be dealt with in some way too. And then again, in the middle of it, you've got the I section. And you remember how chapter 3 begins, I am one who has seen affliction by the rod of the Lord's wrath. And it's not talking about Jerusalem now. It's not talking about a guilty nation. But in chapter 3, it's talking about the individual who's going through grief and what it means to us as individuals to suffer the kinds of things that Lamentations is talking about. And we said on previous evenings as well that there's a particular structure to each chapter which you need to see as you go through. Here's chapter 1 in the Allen version. I wrote this out just for fun. And this is not the best translation in the world, but it's written in a certain way, which you'll see in a minute. Abandoned is the city, bitterly she weeps, cast into exile is she, desolate all her gateways, enemies have remastered her, fled all her hungry princes. Yeah, yeah, and so it goes on. There's no need to read the whole thing. But if you're really awake tonight, you'll have spotted what's going on there already. In terms of the structure that we've already talked about. Whoops, wait a minute, was that in there? Oh no, it's disappeared. So much for this. Well, never mind. I had another slide which showed you, highlighted the bits I wanted you to notice, which were the first letters of every line. If you read down it, it goes A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J. And we said already, haven't we, in this series several times, that the form of each of these chapters is an acrostic. It uses the letters of the Hebrew alphabet going down like that, one verse after another, in perfect order. Why does it do that? Well, the old Jewish Targums, commentaries on the scriptures, which were written hundreds of years later, said it was so that the scribes could memorize it. But that didn't sound convincing at the time, and it's probably not the only reason for it either. It's not a very good way of memorizing anyway. If every line starts with a different letter, you end up thinking, what's Q for? I'm on R now. What's R? And it's not a great aid to memory, really, is it? What other people have said is, it's when you've got an acrostic like that, it's about completeness. It's about the completeness of God's wrath. It's about the way in which not anything is left out. When God judges, he does it properly. Nobody escapes. Justice is done. And that's a possibility too. Or some people have said, it's so that one structure is straining against another. You read through the verses, it's horror, devastation, fear, disaster, fire, flood, and it just seems like a haphazard list of woes. But actually, running at the back of it, there is a structure. There's something going through. Now, that appeals to me, because you find that in many other parts of Scripture too, don't you? In Ecclesiastes, for instance, where you have that little poem in chapter 3 about to everything there's a time, to everything a season, a time to be born, a time to die, and so on. If you look at the things that are mentioned in that list, some of them are desirable, and some of them are undesirable. And if you look at the order they come in, it's kind of desirable, undesirable, undesirable, desirable, desirable, undesirable, undesirable, desirable, 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 undesirable, 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 desirable, desirable, and so on. And you can see, if you look at it in that way, there's a real structure underlying the poem, which you wouldn't see otherwise. And it's as if it's saying, the way we experience life is there's a time to be born, a time to die, a time to sow, a time to mend, a time for this, a time for that. And it all seems completely random and haphazard. But actually behind it, there is a God who is structuring everything. I think something of the same kind is going on in Lamentations. There is a structure behind everything that happens. But the interesting thing in Lamentations is that as you go through the book, you gradually lose the structure. We'll forget about Adele Berlin. Oh, there's the other bit I was looking for. There you are, just to prove it to you. There we are. I've got all my slides in the wrong order. Never mind. As you go through the book, you start to lose the structure. You see, in chapter 1, you've got one verse for every letter of the alphabet in perfect order. But in chapters 2 and 3, two letters get turned around, P and Q. So you've got an almost perfect pattern, but something's gone wrong in it. It's not quite right. And then when you get to chapter 4, then it's different again. In chapter 3 as well, you get much, much more of the alphabet than you used to have. It's not just one verse for each letter, it's three verses for each letter. And here's not mine this time, there's somebody else's attempt to see, show you how that goes in chapter 3. Ah, 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 buh, buh, buh. Then it's k, 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 and duh, 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 and so on and so forth. So it's played about with, it's different, and I think it kind of disintegrates as you go through. So if you look at the way it works, you've got 22 verses in each chapter, apart from chapter 3, which has three verses for each letter of the alphabet, so that's 66. And the acrostic form is perfect in chapter 1. In chapter 2, two of those letters are round the wrong way, which is not quite perfect. In chapter 3, although it's long and big and it's wonderful, there's still that imperfection in the background there. In chapter 4, there's still that imperfection in the background there. And you're back to 22 letters. And in chapter 5, you've still got 22 verses, but the acrostic pattern is completely gone. What's going on there? It's as if some order is dropping out, some harmony is gradually disappearing. As if, just like the people of Israel, gradually drifting further and further away from God, the further you get from God's plan, the more order and harmony and purpose drop out of life, and you're left afloat in a sea of chaos, which is exactly what's happened to the nation of Israel at this time. So that's where it's all going. And so I think there are some things the book of Lamentations, I'm talking about Lamentations tonight, Lamentations is saying to us very, very much. And if before we look at the specifics of chapter 4, I just want to mention what some of those things are. We've talked about most of them in this series before. First of all, it's okay to feel grief. This book tells you it's all right to weep. Sometimes our Christianity can be so triumphant that we just exclude the downside of life in a way that the Bible never does. At the camp where I've been this week, it was a camp for junior kids, 11 to 15. There was a song that somebody brought with them, which is really a children's song, but you know, younger teenagers love pretending they're children. And it really got on my nerves. We're singing it all the time. I'm in right, out right, upright, downright, happy all the time. I'm in right, out right, whatever it was. You get the point anyhow. If I let Jesus in, he'll wash away my sin and make me in right, out right, upright, downright, happy all the time. Happy all the time? That's not the experience of life that I have. It's not the experience of life that many great Christians have had. It's certainly not what's reflected in the book of Lamentations. And sometimes God takes us through seasons of sorrow, tremendous sorrow, when the goalposts seem to have shifted way, way beyond recognition, when we can't really understand what's going on, when it's really hard for us even to believe any longer in the God of mercy. He's really there. The structure still runs behind everything, but we can't see it. And God says through Lamentations, I know, I understand what that's like. I think he's also saying here, it's okay to remember sorrows. Because looking back on what happened to Jerusalem, looking through the specifics, speaking it out, telling it out, that can be important. What we're not supposed to do is bottle it all up, repress it, pretend it never happened, force a smile to our face and say, well, the Lord knows best, and just get on with life. There comes a time when we have to let it out, when we have to shout at the darkness and say, why, God? Why is this happening? What is going on here? And God wants honesty from us. He doesn't want us to pretend a victory and a power and a happiness that we don't have. He wants us to tangle with him in honesty. And sometimes when we're in the darkest places, that's when we experience most of God, isn't it? I've been talking about Daniel all week as well, and it always fascinates me that in chapter 5 of Daniel, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are condemned to be thrown into the fiery furnace, that's where they meet the Son of God. You go right into the heart of the fire, and there's Jesus. And you get to know God better sometimes by going through the fire and the flood than you do by being in the daylight and in the pleasant places. And so I think Lamentations is saying all of that. And it's also saying there are situations where you can do nothing. The great overpowering feeling that you get from the whole book of Lamentations, let's face it, is there's nothing that we can do about it. We've been devastated. We have no comeback. We can't defend ourselves. We can't rebuild our city. God's destroyed it, says chapter 4, right down to the foundations. When a city is set on fire, usually there are foundations left to the houses that you can uncover afterwards. You clear away the rubble, you rebuild the buildings where they are. God's melted down even the foundations. There is nothing left of our city except a heap of useless rubble. We can do nothing. And to people who sometimes feel helpless in life and feel, there's just nothing I can do here, to whom the future seems black and the past seems a question mark, Lamentations can speak quite a bit. And there are situations where logic fails you and words are worthless. If lamentation seems to go around in circles sometime, to come back to the same incidents, if it seems to start on one topic and then go into another, that's the way it feels sometimes too, isn't it? When you're grasping out and trying to get a handle on reality, trying to understand how you should think, how you should act, what God is doing, and how you can reconnect with him when you know you failed so badly, then logic only takes you so far. And beyond that, you need an assurance of something more than that. So it says, too, I think, that God understands the psychology of failure. Sometimes hope is almost obscured by despair. Life is open to horror. Terrible things will happen. And that's one of the great things, it seems to me, about the Bible, that it's a realistic book. I mentioned Ecclesiastes a minute ago, on which I lecture at Bible schools every year. And every year I do it, somebody comes up to me with an improbable story about somebody who was converted just by the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, a book that talks about the meaninglessness and the transitoriness of life and says better to be a dead dog, a live living lion than a dead dog, and just paints as bleak a picture of life as that, you might think, how does anybody become a Christian through that book? But it happens, because it's realistic. It talks about life as it is. It doesn't gild it in fancy colours. And the Bible is like that. It's realistic about the way that life can go into absolute horror sometimes. And so life is open to that. And God makes no promises that he can't keep. And you have to understand that human beings can reduce civilization to horrible extremes sometimes. And we've seen that in history again and again, haven't we? The rape of Nanking, Auschwitz, the aftermath of atomic warfare, the things that have happened in countries like Uganda, Rwanda, where human beings have shown again and again that what keeps civilization going is a very thin tissue of agreement. And once it goes and the evil heart of man speaks out, then all kinds of things can happen. Life is open to horror. So all of those things are in there. It's time we talked about chapter 4, isn't it? Because I've got 10 minutes left and we haven't looked at a single verse of it yet. Let's analyse chapter 4. But I think that background is important to my understanding of chapter 4 anyway. How does it start? It starts with verse 1, surprisingly, most chapters do. And chapter 1 sets the tone for the rest of the chapter. How the gold has lost its luster, the fine gold become dull, the sacred gems are scattered at every street corner. And you understand when you read about sacred gems, he's not just talking about any gold and any jewels, he's talking about the gold and the jewels that were in the house of God. Most of them have been taken off to Babylon, way across the desert, to a heathen temple, and they'll be locked up there for 70 years until one night the king of Babylon commits the ultimate desecration and takes some of the vessels out of the house of God and has a party with them. At that point, God sends a finger to write on the wall, you're weighed in the balances and you're found wanting. A new king takes over the city and he says to the Jews, you must go home and rebuild your temple. But for the next 70 years, all of that treasure, which symbolized the richness and the wealth that God had showered upon his people, the holiness and the importance of a living God, all of that treasure would be the hands of heathens in an unclean temple. And even not all of it would go, because bits would be scattered around the streets as they took the big bits on carts away with them. And the temple gold and the temple gems would be lying disregarded on the street corner. What value were they anyway now? Because what people wanted was food. What people wanted was shelter and clothing. And the gold could buy nothing in a society where there was no money. There was no food to be had. And what was once precious is not precious any longer. And that's the message that I think chapter 4 wants to give us. The difference in chapter 4 and the other poems is that it talks a lot about now and then. What it used to be like and what God has brought us to now. So it spells out the implications of judgment in a way that none of the other chapters do. So he talks, first of all, in verses 2 to 10 about the way that society has just disintegrated. How the precious children of Zion, once worth their weight in gold, are now considered as pots of clay, the work of a potter's hands. The precious children, the people who were the nobles who were going to rule the next generation, the ones who were the up-and-coming leaders of the people, they were like pure gold at one stage. And now they're just pots of clay, the work of a potter's hands. Anything can happen to them. Their life hangs by a thread. Some of them have died meaninglessly already. They have no value. They have no place. They have no job. They have no future. Even jackals offer their breast to nurse their young, he says, but my people have become heartless like ostriches in the desert. Now, commentators are kind of puzzled about why ostriches are supposed to be heartless. And they reckon it's just because ostriches have this habit of laying eggs, covering them over, and going off and leaving them. At any rate, the point is that they show no concern for their young. And that's exactly what happens in a society where it's every man for himself, where the food has run out long ago, and you don't have anything left to feed your children. Because of thirst, the infant's tongue sticks to the roof of its mouth. The children beg for bread, but no one gives it to them. The siege of Jerusalem went on for 18 months before Nebuchadnezzar broke through. Can you imagine what it was like in the city? Because it was already overcrowded. As soon as the word came from the north that the Babylonian army was on the march, people from all over the country, and certainly from the district around, came crowding into Jerusalem, shutting themselves into the safe place. The word had gone out from the king, get yourself to a safe city, and Jerusalem was the safest, so it was massively, massively, massively overcrowded. There wasn't much bread to eat. There was water, because Jerusalem had its own water supply, and that could keep you going for a while, but the food supplies would dwindle very quickly. What's more, the wood would dwindle even quicker than that. How were you to cook any food, supposing you had it? You can't eat grain without cooking it in some kind of a way. What were you going to use for a fire? How was it going to happen? And so, bit by bit, starvation had set in. Malnutrition. People had died. There had been nowhere to bury them. There are suggestions that perhaps the bodies were just thrown over the city walls to the outside. But that wasn't probably done all that often either, because that was just encouragement to the invaders camping outside, waiting their time. Oh yes, people are dying. Oh, they look pretty thin. Well, if they've got nowhere to bury them in the city, that means we'll soon be in there, because they must all be in that situation. And so unburied corpses would have lain in the streets as well. And you can imagine what that meant. Disease, pestilence, plague started to spread. And people started to live in a situation more and more where ordinary family life broke down, where you couldn't take care of your children, and people started living simply for themselves. 5, those who once ate delicacies are destitute in the streets. Those nurtured in purple now lie on ash heaps. The punishment of my people is greater than that of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment without a hand turned to help her. And the city is going downhill. Their princes were brighter than snow and whiter than milk. Their bodies more ruddy than rhubarb. But now they are blacker than soot. They are not recognized in the streets. You go along the street in Jerusalem. You see a couple of bums sitting in the shadows. You turn around to look at these disgusting, disreputable people closely. And with a shock, you realize they're people who were once leaders of society. People who were politicians. People who were minor royals. People whom everybody looked up to at one stage, and now they're just down in the dirt like everybody else. And so it goes on until you reach the horror of verse 10. With their own hands, compassionate children of women have cooked their own children, who became their food when my people were destroyed. And it can be like that, can't it, when society disintegrates. And what God's saying through this, I think, is look, sin is not just a matter of what you do and what I do, it's a matter of what we do together. And a society which turns its back on God is going downhill fast. There is nothing left to bind people together. There is nothing to impose a permanent contract between people. There's nothing to stop the greediness and rapacity of determined people from taking over. Without God, we don't just sin as individuals, we sin as a society as well. And then from verse 11, you're on into a different phase, because having talked about that, he now looks a bit wider. He's not talked about God and why God is doing it in chapter 4 so far, but that's got to be said so that people understand he's not just saying, isn't it a shame what's happening to Jerusalem? Let me show you some pictures of starving children and draw you out in compassion and pity. No, he wants to give the full picture. This is happening because they brought it on themselves. And so he talks about the Lord. And he talks about other people looking on in society around. The Lord has given full vent to his wrath, verse 11. He's poured out his fierce anger. He's kindled a fire that consumed the foundations of Zion. The kings of the earth did not believe that enemies and foes could enter the gates of Jerusalem. They thought this city was impregnable. And now they can't believe it. Their God, who seemed so powerful, has let them down completely. But it happened, says Lamentations, because of the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests. Those who thought they were super holy, those who took airs to themselves, those who, when they walked down the street, expected people to fall back, awed by the air of sanctity that came from them. Now they grope through the streets as if they were blind, verse 14. They're so defiled with blood that no one dares to touch their garments. Just to brush up against a priest or a prophet gave you a great thrill. I've touched Isaiah's robe. Ooh, I got close to Jeremiah. Not any longer. Those prophets, not Isaiah and Jeremiah, clearly, but those who prophesied that the city was going to survive, that God was going to faithfully bring his people out of this trouble, they are hearing birds like, go away, you're unclean, away, don't touch me. And even the heathen nations, even the places outside Israel that they've gone to try to find some refuge, are saying, you can stay here no longer. Nobody wants them. They claim to represent God, and now they've reached the end of the trail as well, because they claimed a message from God that God himself never gave them. And so the Lord has scattered them. He no longer watches over them, verse 16. The priests are shown no honor, the elders no favor. And then in verses 17 to 20, you hit the next part of the description. Our hopes, which were once raised by those false prophets, have come to a crashing, disappointing end. Our eyes have failed, looking in vain for help. From our towers we watched for a nation that could not save us. That's talking about Egypt. Because many people in Jerusalem had been hoping in those last days, when the siege was becoming absolutely unbearable, that Egypt would march in. That the Egyptians would be so threatened by this Babylonian expansion right down to their borders that they'd say, right, enough is enough. We've got to move in and clear the Babylonians northwards again. Never happened. The Egyptians weren't going to bother. They weren't going to do it. And so all the prophets who were saying, the Lord has said to me, the Egyptians are coming tomorrow. If not tomorrow, then next week. They were shown to be lying. It was a false hope. It wasn't going to happen. In the end, Zedekiah, the king, who'd stood out against the Babylonians, tried to get away. And when he did, it didn't work. We don't know the details from any other of the Old Testament history, but this is the best description we've got of the way that Zedekiah was taken by the Babylonians. Our pursuers were swifter than eagles in the sky. They chased us over the mountains and lay in wait for us in the desert. The Lord's anointed, our very life breath, was caught in their traps. Zedekiah tries to make a break for it. The Babylonians are everywhere. He can't get away. And even he, unbelievably, the Lord's anointed, the Son of God, to quote what he was called at his coronation, was taken by heathen soldiers. We thought that under his shadow we would live among the nations. The Israelites had thought that while God's king was there and God's temple was in the city, nothing could happen to them that would shake their security. And they found that their sin could take them further outside God's mercy than they had ever thought they would go. And so those are the problems, says chapter 4, that come to you when you reach God's judgment. Society disintegrates. You don't just go downhill individually, but the whole of the society that's founded upon God's standards and God's principles disintegrates very, very quickly. You begin to understand that you're nothing in the eyes of other people, because they can see the weaknesses, they can see the vulnerability, they can see the failure, and they can deride you as a result. And your false hopes come to an end. Nothing's going to save you. You've reached the end of the rope, or if you like, the bottom of the bucket. There is nowhere else to go. Then at the end of the chapter, you just get a fraction of hope, don't you? In verses 21 to 22, rejoice and be glad, daughter Edom, you who live in the land of Uz. Why? Well, the Edomites were related to the Israelites. They were the children of Esau, just as the Israelites were the children of Jacob. So there's a family relationship between those two nations, which should have meant that the Edomites and the Israelites supported one another. And we don't know how they did it, because the Bible never spells it out, but we know from Joel, we know from Obadiah, and we know from some of the Psalms as well, that the Edomites were concerned in helping the Babylonians in the fall of Jerusalem. And so here, chapter 4 swings round and says, oh, that's great. You're rejoicing right now. But to you also the cup will be passed. You will be drunk and stripped naked. Okay, we are getting the result of what we deserve because of our sin. But you're sinners too. You've broken faith. You've destroyed covenants. You've marched into the land of your weak brother and helped enemies to take it over. You shouldn't have done that. And there is a God in heaven who punishes all wickedness. It's not that God has got it in for us particularly. God is a God of justice. And it's good to think about that, isn't it? When you get in a situation where you're thinking, why me, God? You know you deserve it, but he seems to be putting the boot in on you specifically. He doesn't. God is even-handed in all of his judgments. And everyone who's guilty of injustice is going to meet God's justice one of these days. And then verse 22 says, your punishment won't end, daughter Zion. He will not prolong your exile. And there's your glimmer of hope, isn't it? God is not a vindictive God. He's not somebody who puts the boot in just because he can. Chapter 3 is still going to happen. The mercies of the Lord are new every morning. He's a God of faithfulness. He will listen to the cry of those who repent of their sin and throw themselves upon his mercy. Your punishment will end. He will not prolong your exile. But he will punish your sin, daughter Edom, and expose your wickedness. And so once again, as we go on towards communion tonight, chapter 4 has reminded us of two important things we need to remember when we take the cup and the bread. First of all, that God is incredibly serious about sin. That sin will be punished because God is a God of blazing light, and it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. But second, too, that God is not a God who is angry forever. He's not a God of unlimited wrath. He's a God who says, "Have I any pleasure in the death of the wicked? And not rather that he should turn from his wickedness and live?" And so God is a God of incredible mercy. And as Micah said, who is a pardoning God like you? A God who redeems the iniquity of his people. A God who brings us back to himself. And who through the cross and the resurrection, and through these symbols of the bread and wine, says to us, "I love you, I care for you, I take your sin very seriously, far more seriously than you do. You can get into extreme situations, and yet my love and my faithfulness will not let you go. I'm there for you." And let's rejoice in that.